by October 15th.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory? If you meet the Undertaker, or the young man from the crew, have a pint with what's left over. Now I say goodbye to you. For the bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
I hear that voice. He's back. He's rested. He's tanned. He's back on BAI, the one and only Malachi McCourt, taking a week off last week to recoup, I guess, Malachi, or rehab, or...
Well, I was not well, John, so I had to pop into the hospital. There was a very odd thing was happening to me. I was losing blood, and there was no... They could measure the loss of it, but not where it was coming from or where it was going. So my blood levels were going down. So I was almost bloodless, so they had to give me about 4 pints of blood. The first transfusions I've ever had in my life. So I was in St. Luke's Hospital for, 8, 10 days. And I'm out, up and about, and here we go again, John.
Yes, and we're back on.
I am the sole support of the medical establishment here, so anybody who needs medical attention, it's all on me, okay?
Well, Malachi, we're going to do something today that was in the New York Post, the New York Times, a story that we covered that when it was in the New Yorker with one of your friends, Lori Gwen Shapiro. It took 120 years, but they finally buried Dorothy Parker, and I hope it takes that long for us to bury you 120 years. But it finally happened up in Woodlawn in the Bronx, and we're going to have her on to give what happened when they finally got her ashes up to the Bronx, and your stories of meeting Dorothy Parker and going to Paul O'Dwyer's office at O'Dwyer and Bernstein. And seeing her ashes in a filing cabinet there.
Yep.
So we have a long story that finally ended there during the week.
And we were part of it.
Yeah. Especially that great story that she wrote in the New Yorker. So
right.
Malachi's, now that you're back, what has been irritating you that between hurricanes, we got the evacuation and the fall of Kabul that's going on, and I just see we just did another rocket attack in the town where we killed a kid. So, I mean,
well,
the death and destruction
John,
just goes on.
A few thoughts for this day. It's you know, the poem Yeats wrote, come away, O human child, to the waters and the wild, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand. So here it is, Sunday, supposedly a day of rest, meditation, spiritual reflection, peaceful, loving day. And the world around seems to be erupting in violence. Young people, our young people, merely, in my opinion, boys and girls in uniform, getting killed or maimed and supposedly preserving democracy somewhere in countries that don't welcome us. And many of our own religious citizens applaud the people who have taken up the Taliban. Restrictions on women's freedom. The attitude is being cover up and shut up and open your legs when you are commanded by men who are supposedly more superior to women. And what do we do about the world's troubles? There's Afghanistan, whose natives are Afghans. By the way, I want to tell that to Evan Rosenberg, that Afghanis are is the money, not the natives. And then you have South America, sad stuff happening there, Iran, Iraq, Chad, and Haiti, and everywhere there is trouble. And there's nothing in the world that you can do about the troubles in the ordinary world. So begin your own day with 10 deep breaths. That's the main thing. Take care of your own health. Take breaths, oxygen. We need it because that's what goes when you get that Caliban disease there. And endeavor to find out who in your family needs help, or who in your circle of friends is in need of help, and that's your job. Don't place your trust or your money in ambitious, evil people like Trump who want to take away the power of the people. Keep your concentration on local situations and make sure to vote for the people who advocate for life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And we must be self-concerned these days, John. If you smoke, stop it. If you're an alcoholic, get sober, join AA. If you are fat, lose weight, get into Overeaters Anonymous. If you are depressed, get help. The world has always been chaotic, only our communications were not so swift, and we did not know what was going on there. But I assure you that the world is always like that, and it is not. We can't do anything about it, and we all we need to do is take care of ourselves and breathe deeply and take care of America and vote, vote, vote for the right people. That's it for today, John, for me.
And that was the sermon from Father Malachy McCourt on the Upper West Side to the pilgrims or the patrons of WBAI. Well, Malachy, I'll just add a couple of announcements that we're going to have up on next week's show. We're going to be working with the Irish Repertory Theater because they're going to be on the North American premiere of Angela's Ashes, the musical that Malachy flew over to Limerick just a couple of years ago to watch it live on stage. They did a film version of it, and that will be airing on the Irish Repertory Theater website, and we'll be doing more with them next week about how to go about it. We're going to have some people that were in it that will be on the show. So, Malachy, you also have a book that's going to be republished, which is A Monk Swimming. So
yes.
Come September, you're going to have the musical, and then there's rumors about a couple of blackguards. Your book is being republished. You're hitting on all cylinders with everything that you're involved with.
Well, it's an amazing thing that a family that came out of a slum in Limerick, you wouldn't believe the misery. there we were with 16 families in a lane and had one lavatory, and people came and emptied their buckets, and the stink came right in our door because it was right next door to it. And my father said that if Churchill had any sense, there was one woman's bucket was particularly putrid. And my father said that if Churchill had any sense, he'd come over and he would hire the woman, Bonnie, and her bucket. And all she'd have to do was throw her bucket in the general direction of the German army and they would retreat. And they would be defeated. That was how bad it was. But Frank got typhoid fever out of that place. But anyway, it was a dollar a week was the rent, and that was far too much. Wow. So there it is. The courts are rising
that's
up
it.
Again, and here we go. And what's John
book,
McDonough
movie?
Doing?
Well. Funny you should bring that up. My play Off the Meter about driving a yellow cab for 40 years will be at the New York Irish Center, and we're going to have to comply with the city regulations. So in order to go, you're going to have to be vaccinated, show your card, and you're going to have to wear a mask. And I was down at the Irish Center meeting with George Heslin and Stephen Long there during the week, taking a couple of photos, setting up the stage. But it's going to be October 9th at 3 p.m. and November 13th at 7 p.m. So if you just go to New York Irish Center, type that in Long Island City. Now, the strange thing, Malik, I'm going to find is I will be doing the play without a mask, but the audience will have a mask on. And you know how you can bounce off or get the reaction if you're bombing by looking at the people. Now that they have a mask on, I'm going to be up there looking at them. I'm going to say, oh, my God, I'm bombing, but I can't see I'm bombing. So that's going to be very strange to do that and just looking into the horror of people's eyes when they're saying, I paid this to watch this. So that's going to be a new...
Well, John, let me say this. I saw the show several times.
Yes, you have, and I'm grateful.
It is, you spent decades on the streets of New York, and you have you could occupy more than 2 hours. You could occupy hundreds of hours telling stories and making observations about driving a taxi in every shape, but you have compressed it into a beautiful and marvelous theatrical piece that is it is amazingly accurate, and not alone that, but it is very, 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 very funny as well. Because your kid decided to keep it that way, and the stories are just absolutely irresistible. And I don't care, people. When you're doing your show, those masks will be coming out like little balloons with laughter and hilarity. And so I have there'll be no doubt about it. I mean, your own reaction is that. You're a modest guy, but let me tell you, it is. Let me tell the audience and you, it's a great, great show. One of the best shows you could ever see on a stage, and it's well worth your while. The price is right, and bring friends and on those two dates, and you will be vastly amused, and it lighten your load of your own daily whatever burdens you might have. So get there to the Irish Art Center in Long Island City in October.
Thank you, Maliki. And just not to scare anyone off, I took 40 years of driving a yellow cab and condensed it into 70 minutes, no break. And so this way you can get in and out. And that will be going on also September 12th. That Sunday, the day after September 11th, that on a Saturday, we were supposed to be off because the station does one show every 4 weeks for fundraising. We will be on that day fundraising, and we're going to base it a lot on 9/11, what happened there. We just want to let people know that we will be doing a fundraiser. I'm having on two retired firemen who are well known to WBAI, the Cuba Boys, Jerry Owens and Johnny Sexton. Jerry Owens was one of the last firemen out of the North Tower, and Johnny Sexton was on the ceremonial detail and buried 128 of his friends. And we're going to get into the description of what that is. And it might be in a paper in Ireland, and I'll give you more of an update on that. But, Maliki, some of the music we're going to play today is, yesterday was a big day in Ireland. It was the semifinals of the GAA football. County Tyrone played County Kerry, and County Kerry was supposed to win. It was a walkover. Tyrone was coming down with the COVID virus from County Tyrone, and they won by a point. Now, I listened to the games on RTE Radio 1, and I was so disgusted in listening to it because I was used to the classic host of the GAA games, Micheál O'Hare, where he would be describing each player's, there's so-and-so Donnelly from Castlederga, Ahion, whose brother's working at a building site in the Bronx or Manhattan. And he would have such colorful descriptions of where these people were from, or his grandfather won an All-Ireland back in 1926. these guys just should have straightforward. Here's so-and-so. He's got the ball. He passes it on. And then any time there was a break, and this was a real disgrace on RTE Radio 1, they kept going over to England to get the English Premier League games. And now we go over to Liverpool. Liverpool's winning 1-0 and blah, 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 blah. And then they come back. And Arsenal, at halftime, I was getting the English Premier League instead of analysis. When the game ended, it was all about the English Premier League. Now, we used to have Nolik O'Goira from Galway. You know, he would give us sports, but it would be just GAA hurling and football. He would never in a million years give us the English Premier League scores. And I think RTE trying to squeeze the GAA semifinal in between English Premier Leagues was a disgrace yesterday, and that is ongoing. And you can only hope now with the final coming up against Mayo in 2 weeks' time enough with the English Premier League. I want analysis of the GAA game that was just played in front of our eyes or in front of our ears, and get back with a little color about some of the players, where they're from, where their family was from, how many generations have been playing Gaelic football, because it's an utter disgrace, this jamming in every time. And now they got a water break. Oh, God forbid they should play 35 minutes. They got to take a water break in each half. And during the water break, we now head over to Arsenal. And what's Arsenal doing? And they're like, oh, fun. Come on, man. Let's stick to the game that's in front of us. All right, Malachy. My rant
was
wasn't...
Done. Well, John, just an observation. Over the when RTE started, the radio, well, it wasn't RTE. There was no television. There was no television when they started this. The radio, it was just a radio Éireann, they called it. And Radio Éireann had a predilection toward the British. So if you had a BBC accent, they were all on the RE. They talk like that, you know. And now we're going to Limerick for the... Yes, well, it was a short description of a murder there. And it was sound like that they had it was severely constipated. But they, if you had a BBC accent, that's how you got your job at Radio Air, now subsequently RTE. I don't know if they have changed that or if their tendencies are to go to the BBC and think that they're superior. I don't know what it is, but that has to do, in a sense, that most countries have freed themselves from Britain, like India and other, and Egypt, places have gotten their freedom.
Rhodesia. Yeah, Rhodesia.
And so they are still, here they are still in Ireland, in the north of Ireland. Now, 800 years is a long time. I mean, that's really taking advantage. But, I mean, they should be out by now. And but there's always that thing, always make you feel inferior because you didn't have their accent or their, no matter who, even the lowest of the common Englishmen always thought they were superior to the most intelligent Irish. And the Irish, for some reason, bought that little bit of fantasy and felt inferior to the English. And their English accent comes from George III, who spoke only like he was German, and he did not speak English. And when they were imitating him, that's how it came out. That's how that upper class English accent came. It's German, believe it or not.
Well, Malachy, in honor of Tyrone winning the semifinals, I'm going to have a cousin of mine, unfortunately, died a couple of years ago. I taped him in his house in Donegal singing The Flower of Sweet Strabane, and that is Paddy John McGoldrick. And then we're going to finish up with Derry Farrell. He's a Dubliner, but he went to school in Limerick. And a great song that comes out of Tyrone is The Craig and White Hair, and I'm imaging that the Craig and White Hair is really the Tyrone football team, who they just can't catch. Donegal couldn't catch them. Now Kerry couldn't catch them. And now Mayo is going to have to harness the Craig and White Hair coming down from County Tyrone. But Malachy, we're going to go to the main story right now. I'm going to play a clip It's about the world-famous round table where the New Yorker was founded at the Algonquin Hotel on 44th Street. And out of that, we're going to speak to Lori Gwen Shapiro, who wrote a wonderful article that you were in the New Yorker magazine. But this week, if you read the New York Post or the New York Times right now, has the article that Dorothy Parker was buried up in Woodlawn Cemetery. No, that she didn't just die this week. This has been going on for a long time, and with Malachy discovering her ashes at Paul O'Dwyer's office at O'Dwyer and Bernstein in downtown Manhattan at the law firm down there. So this is going to give you a little history of what it was like, New York City, back in the 1920s. We come out of that, we'll speak to Lori Gwen Shapiro.
New York City, 1920. The First World War was over. Flush with victory and dreams of riches, America was ready for something new. Manhattan was the place to be. New Yorkers were feeling confident and sassy.
We had close to 20 newspapers. There was almost 80 Broadway theaters. The subways cost a nickel. Babe Ruth was playing in the Bronx.
People are watching the invention of the assembly line. The whole idea of the middle class is being invented, the idea of middle class leisure and middle class consumerism. We see the invention of the radio as we know it. We see the first talkies.
With the wedding bells ringing merrily, the organ booming forth its impressive message of...
Oh, shut up.
There's a kind of awestruck mood at how much is going on.
The connoisseurs of the new culture could be found at a daily lunch, at a circular table, inside a hotel called the Algonquin. They became known as the Algonquin Round Table.
They were underemployed writers and editors, and they just enjoyed each other's company, and they all had an affection for the English language.
All the things I really like to do are either immoral, illegal, or fattening.
That woman speaks 18 languages and can't say no in any of them.
Why don't you get out of that wet coat and into a dry martini?
Every day for 10 years, this group of wisecrackers, wordsmiths, poets, and cynics would breathe new life into American humor and captivate the public with their effortless wit.
Anything can happen, but it usually doesn't.
Beauty is only skin deep, but ugly goes clean to the bone.
It was the era of, like they said, wonderful nonsense.
The Algonquin Roundtable was part of a decade that, while it lasted, would be unlike any in history.
That gives you a little bit what New York was like just before Malachy arrived in the 30s. But Malachy, and we have Lori Gwen Shapiro on, and for our audience, before we get into what happened this week, who was Dorothy Parker? And you got your friend on. You can talk to her. I'm sitting back like the rest of the
Malachy,
audience now.
Hi, Malachy. Why don't you start with your thoughts, and then I'll chime in.
Well, Dorothy Parker was considered to be an upstart in New York or in the United States. Then was a kind of predominantly male society where only all the words of males were quite superior. Women's words were babble, and women's brains were not supposed to be anywhere near that of the male. And any kind of a wisecrack or a humorous remark from a woman was considered. It was considered in the same way that revolutionaries were considered, that really you almost got a death sentence for it. But Dorothy Parker was one of those women who they totally ignored the ordinary things of the day and broke all the rules and joined up in this Algonquin round table. There was one in England at one time, Oscar Wilde and various other people gathered for lunch, and they prepared their wisecracks to go down in history. But anyway, that was That was that was the situation in the 20s that Dorothy Parker zoomed into and just dominated. And Laurie Shapiro, have documented that.
Well, I think the reason that I'm joining today is to help celebrate that she has, a year after Kevin Fitzpatrick of the Dorothy Parker Society and I brought her home on an Amtrak train from Baltimore to Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. She has now, a year later, received a very proper gravestone, which was actually funded by her many fans as well as some of her remaining descendants. But one of the things that amazed me as I started that article last year was that I realized that Malachi McCourt, who I knew from a different stage of my life, was one of the actually knew Dorothy Parker. And I'm wondering if you could tell your audience how you knew Dorothy Parker in life and death.
Yes, I was in Hollywood, as they say. Mm-hmm. So I forget what I was doing there, but I was doing something. And I went to a party thrown by George Stevens, the son of the filmmaker. And so anyway, I was drinking at the time, and I'd had a few. And there was an elderly woman seated by the window. So I went over and I to her because there was nobody talking to her, and I introduced myself. I didn't get her name, but anyway, I said, "And what are you doing tonight?" She said, "Well, I'm going home." And I said, "I would like to take you home to my home." And she said, "Young man, if you think you're flattering me, you're vastly mistaken." Oh, I said, "I'm not trying to flatter you at all." I said, "I find you very sexy." And she laughed. And we became, we got into a great conversation. And she then told me, well, her name was Dorothy Parker. Now, I am not well educated, so I did not know. I knew vaguely about a Dorothy Parker, who had been a witty person. Mm-hmm. And I realized that's who it was. So I was vastly impressed, and that shut me up.
What year was that again? What year for the audience was this happening about?
This must have been sometime in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Because you were out in California trying to make it
as an actor. I was in California, yeah. What she was doing there, I don't know. But I was there temporarily.
She was living there briefly.
So was she. So some years later, I was at Paul O'Dwyer's office downtown, and I was going to have lunch with him. So he said, "Come by the office." And so anyway, I was in his office, and he was fussing about with something. And I don't know how it came up, or I think it was something about his glasses or something. So anyway, the name Dorothy Parker came up, and I said, "Oh, I met her in California." And Paul said, "Would you like to meet her again?" "Oh, my God, yes, I would love to, now that I know who she is, really, because I read up on her afterwards." And he went to his file cabinet and pulls out this urn. And there she was. "Here she is," he said, "in the urn, Dorothy Parker." So I met her twice, in life and in death.
Tell the audience why she was in a filing cabinet of a desk lawyer's office.
She had been in the NAACP. She left all her money to Martin Luther King and to the WNCP, and they had buried her in their front yard in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And they were moving. And so they didn't know what to do about it, but that's where you came in. You rescued her there, didn't you not? Sorry?
Well, I think what was so fascinating, well, first of all, the person that was really fighting for this over the years was a gentleman named Kevin Fitzpatrick, who had started about 15 years ago this campaign to get her out of Baltimore. I think that the gesture to get her to Baltimore was originally well-meaning back in the 80s when Dorothy Parker's original lawyer was Oscar Bernstein, who was partnered with Paul O'Dwyer. And when he died, Paul O'Dwyer sort of inherited this urn. There was a great problem with who's paying for her funeral. And she had no children. Her husband had died. And basically, Lillian Hellman was named as the executor. And when she did not leave money to her, I'm not going to be the one to say it. Others have said it before me. She wasn't a very honorable executor. And she just didn't pay for the fees for her to be buried. And she just left her with Dorothy's lawyer's office. And that's how the Bernstein and O'Dwyer got the urn. But I think
that's
that Paul O'Dwyer was feeling that his own age creeping up, and he wanted something to be done with this urn. And in the 1980s, Liz Smith, the gossip columnist, ran a whole campaign to try to come up with ideas, and some of the ideas were crazy, just like wackadoodle. And I think that the NAACP, who inherited a lot of the rights for her state, because basically Dorothy Parker was a very big champion of civil rights. A lot of people didn't know that. I didn't know that until I started the story.
Yeah.
And there was a caveat on an asterisk on the will that if anything happened to Martin Luther King, everything should go to the NAACP. And to this day, many of her stories and poems and songs that are still in copyright help fund civil rights in the United States, which is amazing. But what
so
do you think
any money
this
that
earned,
emanates from them goes to the NAACP. And the thing was that they moved with Baltimore, wasn't it?
Yes, but what happened was a lot of New Yorkers at that time were aghast. Dorothy Parker in Baltimore? I mean, nothing against Baltimore, but this was the quintessential New Yorker.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was the best solution that could be. They funded a little bit of a grave for her in a building. It unfortunately is very close to the parking lot of that spot, but they recently moved. So Dorothy Parker was now alone in suburban Baltimore, in a parking lot with hardly, I mean, everything was getting decrepit, and I think the original intent was good, but it was a perfect opportunity for Kevin Fitzpatrick to now up his campaign and reach out to the NAACP and say, let's get her back to New York. And last year, in the middle of the pandemic, we went there to secretly get her out of New York. It was a very secret operation, stealth. And we got her on the Amtrak, and we got her in the middle of the pandemic.
Before you get on the Amtrak.
Sure.
How was she in the urn in the grave?
I wish you were there, because we were just beside ourselves. We thought that they're going to dig, and there was one old, you know, she was half Jewish. She went to Catholic school, but she was half Jewish. So there was a rabbi there who had been at the original burying of the urn in the late 80s. And he kind of thought, you know, what this thing looked at, but nobody looked at the plans. And we had a whole team of people drilling, and we thought this was going to be, you know, she's going to be popped out in 20 minutes and we'll be on the train. And it like chainsaws are coming out. It just went on for hours. And we're just thinking, is Dorothy ever coming home to New York? This isn't going to happen. We're going to miss our train, too. But at the very last minute, they were able to jackhammer through concrete, and there was the urn. And that is the urn that has been brought back and is in Woodlawn now underground.
Yeah. So you got her out, and you carried her on the train
well,
to New York.
I think that Kevin would not let Dorothy Parker out of his sight. She was in a box. The urn was put in a special box that he built.
Yeah.
And then he had, you know, it was the height of the pandemic last summer. So it still is, but it was, nobody knew anything. We were all wearing masks. There's very few people on the train. But yeah. He had her on one seat next to him, and I was on the opposite aisle. And he said, let's have a gin and tonic.
And
he brought,
gin.
You know, a good Dorothy Parker society president always has a lime on him and a knife.
Yeah.
And out came the gin and the tonic, and we celebrated on the train. And then we got to the next – I think that Dorothy Parker spent the night in Kevin's apartment and with his wife, and they maybe saw a bit of Netflix, I don't know. And then the next day we were trying to keep the secret because, meanwhile, in Baltimore, everybody was saying there's a hole in the ground. Where the hell is Dorothy Parker? And there were all these articles starting to break, but we knew the secret. We had keeping a New York secret is not easy. And finally, I had for a year been assigned this from the New Yorker, and we were able to get a photographer to come with us, and that was the article that came out in the beginning of September, The Improbable Ashes of the Improbable Journey of Dorothy Parker's Ashes, which I wrote for the New Yorker. But this week marked another occasion when, as I said, her fans, through sales of gin, Dorothy Parker gin, and contributions, T-shirts from the Al Hirschfeld Society did a T-shirt with Dorothy Parker's image on it that helped raise money. And then she has three wonderful grandnieces alive, Susan Cotton, Nancy Accaro, and Joan Grossman. And they also, they live in central New York, and they just remembered her as small children, but they helped give what they can. But a big gravestone that's fitting of Dorothy Parker, it is expensive, and she was buried in a plot near her parents. So Woodlawn is a beautiful place in the Bronx. It's very bucolic, and she's in her family plot, and she's back in New York, and I hope that everyone goes to visit her now. I hope, you know, there were roses at her grave, and we all had cocktails. Woodlawn allowed cocktails for Dorothy Parker's funeral service. And there was a ceremony, a lovely ceremony with music before.
Who conducted was there a clergyman?
I don't know how religious she was, but there was a few words. I think what was interesting though is that she was born in a hurricane, and the actual event had to be delayed a day because of the hurricane we had.
When was she born, Laurie?
At the end of the 1890s. And so she died in the late 60s. And as I said, she was married to Alan Campbell twice, but she was not, they never had, and she was married to, Mrs. Parker comes from her first husband, Mr. Parker, and that was a very short-lived marriage, but she kept that. Her real name was Rothschild, and she was, from the Upper West Side, like yourself, but she was, born on a family the end of August, in August 22nd, out in New Jersey when they were away for the weekend. But she always felt that kept her from claiming a true New York City native New Yorker status. But she was back in New York within her first week of life. But it was amazing that this hurricane really foiled us again, because her family was coming in from all over, the remaining descendants, you know, not her direct descendants, but, you know, connected family.
Right.
And they had to go back after Sunday. And we had the ceremony the next day on Monday. But it was still lovely.
Do you have a favorite quote of hers?
Sorry?
Do you have a favorite quote?
Oh, I do. I actually put it into the article, which is you could. Well, there was quips. They used to have a game, the Algonquin, where people would come up with quips. You know, yes. They would draw a word out of a bowl and then have to make a sentence. And she got something like, a whore or something, and she said, "You can lead a whore to culture, but you can't make her drink." I mean, she had a ribald sense of humor, and I love that. I think one of the things that a lot of New Yorkers think about Dorothy Parker is that she's very New York. I make a crack when I'm in another city, and people look at me sideways, and there's sort of a safe island here.
It is. Well, there was another, I know in England that they had another kind of a gathering where people like Oscar Wilde and Whistler, the painter, he was apparently, he was a great wit as well. And one of my favorites is that Oscar Wilde said, Whistler said something very funny. And the man who wrote, Whistler's mother, and mm-hmm. Eve who painted. But anyway, he said something very funny, and Oscar Wilde said, "That was very funny, Whistler. That was very funny. I wish I had said it." And Whistler said, "You will, Oscar, you will." And that was that he was a repetitive sort of fellow. But isn't that, it must have been a terrific strain on people at the round table to come up with maybe 10 or 12 people gathering there. It wasn't very difficult to sit there straining to think of something amazingly brilliant that was going to collapse the whole crowd.
I remember years ago you told me that you used to be part of your own gathering. I believe it was called First Fridays.
Well, First Friday Club, yes.
Can you tell us about that? Because I'm curious if you had some of the same responsibilities to be clever.
Yes, I felt it a bit myself. Well, the founding of it, why I called it the First Friday Club, that in Catholic Church, the First Friday used to be a religious holiday. You had to go to Mass, and you were supposedly go to communion. But if you did 9 First Fridays in a row, you were guaranteed not to die without a priest. I don't know why they could say that. You could be if you were in the Sahara. How could it be? But anyway, but in our case, in the First Friday Club, if you did 9 First Fridays, you were guaranteed not to die without a bartender. So that was my contribution.
And who was in the First Fridays, Malachy? Who were some of the people in it?
Well, some James T. Farrell came, Dennis Smith came, Terry Moran, Frank was a member, Jimmy Breslin came, Pete Hamill came. Various writers popped in at one time.
That's quite luminous,
It was at Eamon Doran's over on the east side for a long time, and then it kind of disappeared. People, it was an amazing thing that happened. A lot of people started dying, and so it's been out of action for a while. But I'm going to revive it. Because we can't let all the dead rest in peace.
Well, if you want to invite me, I'd be happy to come and try to be witty.
Absolutely. I mean, you represent Dorothy Parker, and that was very good. So there was an amazing gathering then up in the Bronx recently.
I really believe that. You might be the last person to have, other than Paul O'Dwyer, to have seen her in a very casual setting before she was brought in Baltimore. I mean, it was such an amazing coincidence that, I know for people in the audience, my connection to the McCourts goes back pretty far. First of all, Frank McCourt was my high school English teacher and mentor at Stuyvesant.
And then I was friends with Connor McCourt and helped him, Malky's son. And there were two wonderful HBO Cinemax films that Connor directed, The McCourts of Limerick and The McCourts of New York. And I had the real privilege of traveling with all four brothers. And I feel like you're part of my family, to be honest.
We had that strange venture back to India, if you recall.
I know. Do people know about why you were in India? Perhaps you could tell your own story here.
Well, it's we went back because I was a gold smuggler to India, and Connor was going to make put that one in a document. He did put it in a
he
documentary,
did.
And we were going back over my visits to various. When I followed when I used to go to funerals in India, I loved the singing and everything. Mm-hmm. And we went to where the crematorium, if you recall.
We certainly did.
And we were trying to film there.
Bringing it back to the subject of ashes.
Yeah, you remember they got very upset when I stood. I told Connor, as you recall, that I would casually stand near a corpse that was about to be cremated, and he could film me, but that it was quite accidental and all that. But the relatives caught on to the trick, and they told me we were disrespecting the corpse. Anyway, they ordered us away from being in the vicinity of their corpse that they were about to cremate in outside. In Bombay. Remember, they got angry. The man got very angry at us.
It just seems so... It's funny because when you think back to Dorothy Parker and meeting her, you're thinking back to the 60s, and I'm thinking back to the 90s, and it seems so long ago.
Yeah.
And time is silly that way, isn't it?
It is indeed. There's nothing you can do about it. It's inexorable. That's what it is.
Well, I'm so
I'm so proud that when I tell
the story of Dorothy Parker, that you're part of it. Everybody says to me, "How did you get a McCourt into this story?" I said, "I didn't have to do anything." I couldn't believe it. I was doing my research, and I suddenly realized that there was one comment about you're doing this, and you were so gracious to let me interview you and keep the New York secret, because you were in on the secret as well, that we were bringing Dorothy Parker in. You were one of those New Yorkers who were able to keep this quiet.
Yes, yeah.
But
well,
Baltimore got very upset.
There was somebody something that I had to turn them down or something. I couldn't tell them because I'd already told you that I would keep quiet about it. Until your
right, and I think what happened is that there was articles in the Times and then in the Baltimore Sun from journalists who were trying to figure out, like, where is Dorothy? Where is Dorothy? And of course, you knew, and Kevin knew, and I knew, and the editors of The New Yorker knew. And it was just so, but the whole thing has a bit of hijinks about it with the gin and tonics on the Amtrak. And I think that Dorothy would have really enjoyed reading the story of how her ashes came back to New York.
Yeah. Did you? I was trying to remember. I don't know whether you were joking or not, Laurie, but did you pay for a ticket for her to go to?
Did I what? Sorry?
Did you pay for a railroad ticket for her?
Oh. Yes, for the railroad ticket, no, we didn't. We only had adult fares.
Yeah.
But she did have, I mean, fortunately, because of the pandemic, it was a very risky endeavor at that time. And the New Yorker was not thrilled with having any travel, but we were very safe. We followed all protocols. But there was a lot of... extra seats, shall we say, on the train.
Security, yeah.
And she
John
got
McDonough's
her own seat.
John McDonough's with us, Laurie.
Sorry?
John McDonough's, are you there, John?
Malachy, I am just sitting back here, and I just remember the time I was driving you and David Rothenberg and the two of you talking and telling Dorothy Parker stories, going up Sixth Avenue and trying to top each other about, oh, yes, I remember this time. And then David would have a story. And I that was just wonderful sitting there driving. And I feel like the same way now. I'm just sitting back here listening to you and Lori talking really New York history. And Lori, when this got into New York, what is the reaction? Because a lot of times stories go in and then it ends. Was there much of a reaction? Did a lot of people read the story? Because I guess now they can tell if they don't get the magazine. They see it online.
Actually, it was really interesting because we had to rush the story in the end because everything was breaking because there was a hole in the ground in Baltimore. And people were putting wrong information in the newspapers, including the Times, I hate to say, and the Baltimore Sun. And the grandnieces up in central New York all knew what was going on because everything was being done with their permission. They did not want to travel during the pandemic, wisely. Basically, I was in the dentist's chair when I heard that the Baltimore Sun was going to be writing this big article, but they didn't actually know the story. I mean, and I knew that I had been there. I had been on the train. I had been, you know, with the story for a year. I interviewed the grandnieces, and it came out, I guess, Labor Day weekend, and it was actually a great time to hit because it was right before a lot of the politics were coming back into the news, and it went very viral. And I'm very proud that it has won two journalism awards. But part of it, I think, was helped by Malachi McCourt because he gives this little bit of a beat of, like, you can't believe this in the middle of the story. I mean, Malachi's experience is part of this article, which you can find online. Again, it's called The Improbable Journey of Dorothy Parker's Ashes. And I'm just so happy that I had the inside track to get to Malachi quickly and have that recorded forever. It made me very happy. As someone who's been connected to the McCourt family, and I've told this to my friends, but we became so close to the McCourts, my family, that Malachi actually did the service for my secular Jewish mother. And, I mean, that's how connected. So to have someone that you feel very connected be part of a story that you're working on, I remember my editor said, can you get to Malachi McCourt? And I said, yeah, I can get to Malachi McCourt.
And Lori,
I rang him on the phone and he said, hello.
and Lori, one final question for me. You're talking about the McCourt. What
yes.
type of influence and what type of teacher was Frank McCourt at Stuyvesant? And did it influence you to go into writing?
Oh, absolutely. I was, believe it or not, people think I'm pretty gregarious and adventurous, but I was a pretty shy person up until I had Frank McCourt's class. And he took me aside and he said, I have bad news for you. You're a writer. But he gave me some confidence. I remember seeing a couple of blackguards at high school with Malachi and Frank, and I just looked up to these guys, and I wanted to be part of that world. And he kept in touch with me, and one of the reasons that I got connected to the film in the first place was because of Frank. I didn't know Malachi as well until I was involved with the film. And I believe that I wrote a novel in 1998 called The Unexpected Salami with Algonquin Books. And I believe I was the first book that came out from one of his students. And he wrote the blurb on the back. So I have a Frank McCourt blurb on my first book.
Wow.
It was just, but he was lovely, and they're very different. I knew I loved Mikey, and I loved Alfie and Frank, and I knew all of them. And I was part of, as Malachi knows, Connor filmed the brothers bringing part of Angela's ashes back to the cemetery where their sister was in a pauper's grave, and I was there for that. And Frank broke down crying. You know, Frank was always stoic, and to see Frank McCourt crying was something. And I always tease Maliki because he brought part of Angela's ashes in a Modell's bag. I said, are you sure? And we kind of left that in the film. Connor just started laughing. He's like, Dad. But it was and I got to travel in Limerick with the McCourt brothers. I don't think anyone could say that's a finer thing than that. I was down on the lanes with Frank and saw them in their hometown, and it's really shaped my life. And I know Frank would say, write what you know. And I mean, I write about New York. I know New York. I'm a native New Yorker, and I'm really proud of it. And I'm very proud of my mentors, including Maliki and Frank.
Well, Maliki, we're closing in on noon here in New York City, and having two New Yorkers talking about New Yorkers. It's to me, it doesn't get any better on WBAI, a true New York station, doing this.
Well, John, would you say, even though I was born in Brooklyn, I'm a New Yorker?
Oh, yeah. Oh, listen. Okay. Anybody that can go to the Brooklyn Cyclone game and throw out the first ball and then tell Trump jokes at a Trump crowd in the Brooklyn Cyclones is a true New Yorker. Yes, I have
and
to say.
Thank you
very
Parker.
Much, John. I feel crowned now. Okay. So...
Dorothy Parker's
Lori
smiling
Shapiro,
somewhere.
We are both New Yorkers. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well,
the story is eternal, Dorothy Parker, and she's there in the grave now, resting
forevermore.
In peace. Always alive. What is it? Men never make
passes at girls who wear glasses.
Yes.
Rarely make passes, I believe. But I will tell again, the audience listening, that it's a beautiful gravestone. Woodlawn is a beautiful place. And please go and visit her and leave a rose for her. And you'll see why when you see what her gravestone says. And
or a bottle of gin, would that be okay?
Sorry?
Or a bottle of gin.
Oh, yes, Woodlawn is all aboard. They know who they have there. And she's buried very nearby the America's first celebrity bartender. Which is somewhat fitting.
That is
and Herman
funny.
Melville. Pick who you prefer.
Oh, my God. That's
apparently people leave little whales for Melville.
Yeah.
They leave little toy whales for him. What would you like left? I don't know. But Dorothy Parker, you certainly can have a drink near her gravestone. Woodlawn would love that. They would want you to come visit her.
Well, I think what I would like on my grave would be, if I were in a grave, is some soda bread and butter.
Soda bread.
and Kerrygold butter.
Oh, yes, right.
Okay.
All right. Well, Maliki, now that we've tied all of that up, I thank you, Lori. You've been listening for the past 40 minutes.
Thank
New York
Maliki.
Stories.
Thank you very much, Lori.
Okay.
Lori Gwen Shapiro writes for the New Yorker magazine, and Maliki McCourt writes for everyone. He's got books coming out. He's got a musical coming out, and we'll be doing a special on the 12th here on WBAI. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And right now we're going to play a one-minute clip of the voice of Dorothy Parker. And when she comes out, Maliki, I want to do another rant and then maybe take some phone calls. So this is Dorothy Parker in her own words. It's called Inscription for the Ceiling of a Bedroom.
Inscription for the Ceiling of a Bedroom. Daily dawns another day. I must up to make my way. Though I dress and drink and eat, move my fingers and my feet, learn a little here and there, weep and laugh and sweat and swear, hear a song or watch a stage, leave some words upon a page, claim a foe or hail a friend. Bed awaits me at the end. Though I go in pride and strength, I'll come back to bed at length. Though I walk in blinded woe, back to bed I'm bound to go. High my heart or bowed my head, all my days but laid to bed. Up and out and on, and then ever back to bed again. Summer, winter, spring and fall, I'm a fool to rise at all.
Well, Malachi, that was the one and only, the voice of Dorothy Parker, and thanks to YouTube, I mean, you can almost get anything. It's almost like Amazon. You can get anything you want, and I was glad I had that little clip. I think it's great.
Well done,
through
John.
Through
I'm
technology.
Thinking, John, I'm thinking that I was thinking that radio and all the mediums are filled with such bad news and everything. I'm just delighted that, that you and myself were able to bring a little lightness to radio, that we could have I think we had a laugh or two as well today. And I think it's okay. And I want to tell people, don't get into world affairs. Don't get depressed, because everything is getting so heavy. Breathe deeply and take care of yourself. That's the thing. And listen to us on Sundays, and it will help you get over whatever you're suffering from. Put down the weights. Don't be carrying the world's troubles with you. It's not worth it. You can't do anything about it. All you can do is something about yourself. You can't do anything about the past. And the future is not here. Take care of it today. And just now, I think we're going to go to You Can Speak on our radio show.
Yeah, I was going to just one quick little rant, and then I'm going to play a song from cousin of mine in honor of Trump. No, covering, now that you're talking about being upbeat, I'm going to be downbeat, about the coverage that's going on in Afghanistan. And I'm always amazed, because I am like David Rothenberg. I go Fox, CNN, MSNBC. They keep going back to see the coverage. Now, CNN and MSNBC would still have you believe that Trump was still president, because they just won't give up on him. And Fox would have you believe that Trump was never president and that everything that's going on is Biden's fault. But CNN, to their shame, and I guess it's because that they couldn't find Kissinger at the time, wanted to know if we should go back to war or go back into Afghanistan. And who do they dust off and bring in? Is John Bolton. Now, oh my God, I saw him with his mustache. Somebody should shave that bloody thing. But CNN has him on and say, "Well, Mr. Bolton, how do you feel about what's going on in Afghanistan?" Like, you really had to ask that question? Of course it's a disaster. We have to send in more troops. But here's a quote from Bolton in his Yale yearbook of the 25th reunion. And he says, "I confess, I had no desire to die in Southeast Asia in a rice paddy. I considered the war in Vietnam lost." But now he has no problem of saying, "I don't mind 20-year-olds being sent to Afghanistan." And I just wanted to bring up the hypocrisy on all of that. But Malachi, the number here, if you want to tell a Dorothy Parker story, if you want to talk about what's going on in this crazy world, the number here is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. What I'm going to do is play a two-minute song of a cousin of mine who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, Packy John McGoldrick, who's from Donegal. And I taped him back in the 80s, and I'm dedicating this song to the County Tyrone football team. They won the semifinal yesterday and would be playing Mayo. And this one is "The Flower of Sweet Strabane."
"I were king of Ireland, and all things at my will, I'd roam for recreation. You come first to find still. You come first I would seek the most, yous all would understand, is to won the heart of Martha, the flower of sweet Strabane. Our cheeks they are a rosy red, our eyes a lovely brown, And o'er her lily-white shoulders a hair of brown hangs down. She is one of the finest creatures, and famous is her clan. And my heart is captivated by the flower of sweet Thraban. I wish I had my darling girl way down in Inishone, or in some lonesome valley in the wild woods of Tyrone. I do my best endeavor, I try to work my plan, for to win the heart of Martha, the flower of sweet Thraban. I've often been to Phoenix Park, I've been in Killarney's fair, I've been to bonny Scotland and the winding banks of Erne. But yet in all my travels there is none of them so grand, or a girl so sweet as Martha, the flower of sweet Thraban. Farewell to bonny Lifford, where the sweet moorland water flow, and likewise to my brown-haired girl, since I from her must go. As down Lough Foyle the waters boil, my ship stands out from land. I'll say goodbye, and God bless you, my flower of sweet Thraban.
That was Malachy, my cousin, Packy John McGoldrick. And I can't tell you, late night in a pub, and when he would come in, everyone would be silent. Packy John's here. He's going to sing a few songs or do a recitation. And the last time I was overseeing him, I said, do you do that anymore? He says, listen, I couldn't be bothered. Any of the pubs you go into, all the TVs are on. Everybody's on their cell phone. He says, no one even cares about having like a session like that. And I just thought that was so sad that before all this new electronics, that people would come in and have their party piece. And you would say to them, come on, give us that song you have. But that seems to be a bygone era, Malachy.
It is indeed, John. It's the intrusion of the media, and it gives everybody the same way of thinking, and it puts people on either side, for or against. And there's the incursion of politics now and philosophy. It's more thinking, and people get so angry these days. But anyway,
well, Malachy,
it's not going to be that way.
Speaking of anger, we're going to go to our first call. I want to give out the number again: 212-209-2877. We do have a few people lined up. And we're going to have Russell from White Plains, who's known over at WABC as the commie from White Plains and a frequent caller into Frank Morano, the other side of midnight. But Russell, should we be in Afghanistan, or are you glad we're getting out? What's your take?
Well, we're never getting out. They're having a fight. The Pentagon is fighting the CIA and Biden's Chinese friends. So we're never leaving that place. But I want to make one thing clear. I never called Malachy a fascist. Malachy never approaches people in the street shaming and bullying like a certain host who was proud to do it. Malachy's exhibiting fascist leanings because he's fooled by the media, government, corporate elite. But what's ironic is that you have these so-called Cuba boys who ruined David Rothenberg's call-in show by obsessively denying WBAI listeners and callers the joys of dialogue with David Rothenberg. They are anti-free speech clowns. Think about what you're doing. Reflect and repent.
All right. I think Russell could fall into that. Malachy, you have fascist tendencies. David Rothenberg is just a full-out fascist. We all know that. But you have the tendencies, and I don't know, Malachy, he seems to be thinking you're leaning that way now.
Well, I'm leaning to the left at the moment.
But you're leaning so far left, you're on the right now.
I've gone... Well, they say it's a kind of a circle, isn't it, John?
Yes, it is. I always
believe in, and I just think that people should do what I tell them. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
that's not fascist.
All right, the number here is 212-209-2877 WBAI. You're on the air. Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I can hear something.
It's you.
Yes. As the old saying is, turn off your radio, and you're on the air. Well, I don't know about that call. I guess, they were so fascinated or scared off by Russell, maybe. Who knows? But the number here, we're only going to be on for another 10 minutes because the song I'm finishing up with is the Craig and White Hair, probably one of the most famous Tyrone songs sang by Derry Farrell. 212-209-2877. Now, come on. You have Maliki, the potential fascist. You can ask him and he'll tell you why you're wrong at 212-209-2877. WBAI, you're on the air. Oh, there's no one there. This is what kills me now. Now that I say there's no one there.
That's strange. Most people take the opportunity to get on with us, express their opinions, pro and con, and we do not. Censor you. I don't know. Do people believe in censorship? And the thing, unfortunately, in our system here, people define words as not by meaning or by the sound of them. Like there's a word that begins with, you know, hockey puck, there's a word that rhymes with puck. Now, you can't say that. But in actual fact, that word comes from a legal thing that used to be in English legal system, which was a crime. And it was for unlawful...
Maliki.
For unlawful something. Yeah.
Maliki, I just want to jump in because you get so close to whatever you're saying, and with your accent, I can see us in front of the Supreme Court now. Mm-hmm. But we do have
let me finish it, John.
Okay.
For unlawful carnal knowledge. That's what it is. Now, why is it that you can, and some clerk, abbreviated that for the first letters, so that's how that word came about, and it's an English word, and it is about having sex. Of course it is, but you can't say it on the air, and you cannot say. You can say words about to describe your internal about your wee wees and your. And everything else that you do, but you can't say the word that begins with that rhymes with it, and so on. It's so amazing that offenses. Now, here's what I was going to say. There's no such thing as bad language. There is only bad usage. There is no such thing as bad language. There is only bad usage.
All right. Well, Maliki, we have a genuine fascist on the line. He's back from mass patrol on 13th Street and 7th Avenue. He's taking time out to call in, and it's the one and only Mr. David Rothenberg. David.
Oh, my God.
I wanted to talk fascist to fascist. I think we have a lot in common.
David, Henry I wanted Kimmler to correct you on
Henry
something.
Henry Kimmler to Joe Goebbels, as it were. And please don't.
I wanted to correct you on something, David, yesterday.
Right.
The natives of Afghanistan.
Oh, I heard your correction. I stand corrected.
Oh, good enough, then. You just have to have a bowel movement.
And what's the word I can't say beside wee wee?
Yeah, it rhymes with it.
Oh, yeah, you're not allowed to say that one. And I almost said it. So in my response to Russell, from a fascist perspective, some people, you make a decision. It's not just so much to suppress people, but to avert boring radio.
Yeah.
And that there are some people who are predictable and therefore don't make for interesting radio. And so you choose not to share the air with them. And you suggest they get their own program, except that they're so uninteresting that nobody would probably give them one. And that's why God created the Internet.
Well, and I hear the fire engines coming for you, David, outside.
So
it is.
The wonderful thing about
it,
the Internet, what Trump has done, what Trump did, is he, with fake news, he invalidated all the media that has accountability. And so his yo-yos listen to or pay heed to the alternate media, which has no validity and has no accountability and never heard of double-checking on a source. So that's why God, that's why we have so many not vaccinated, because they pay heed to the Internet.
That is, they make a medical thing a political thing. That, to me, is absolutely absurd. And the other thing, too, is that we must never, we can have friendships and we, which are devoted and faithful and everything, but we can't be going around saying that any man is such, is right in everything, as the poor Germans did with Adolf and that crowd that are doing with this Trump.
Don't knock my buddy.
It's amazing how people would say that.
But Maliki, do you realize that with the vaccinations and the anti-science, I haven't heard any of those folks question the scientific ingredients that made Viagra or penicillin that cured their syphilis.
And you know what, David? You told a very interesting story about the Fortune Society of people who were hooked on drugs. And said, you're not getting the vaccination, but you had no problem going to the corner to cop dope.
Yeah, well, that was one of the guys at the meeting when they were talking about whether they should get it on. He said, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but many of the people in this room, we got needles. We didn't ask where they came from. We didn't ask what was going into our arm. And suddenly, when there's a vaccine that might protect our lives, we're questioning the source of it and the validity of it. It was interesting.
And everything.
But all the people that are taking, but everybody we know is on some sort of prescription drug. They don't challenge it. They take penicillin. They take opioids or whatever it is.
Opioid. Yeah.
That too.
Also, this vaccination it's mandatory vaccinations for every infant now for smallpox.
And they're saying the Pentagon is insisting soldiers do it. When I went into the Army, they stuck a needle before basic. You walk down the aisle and they're sticking a needle. You don't ask what, where, why. They just
steps.
Did it.
Yep.
David, you had a very funny.
To understand.
David, you gave the obituary of 5 radio hosts who were against vaccination yesterday.
Yeah, that died. Was very sad. Conservative radio hosts died of the virus, and they had made a career out of blasting the validity of it, of the vaccination. It's sad that they went. I don't wish people who don't get vaccinated ill. I just wish they'd agree with me. That's the fascist in me. I want everybody to agree with me. I just don't want people to get sick.
How do you know when a conservative is dead? That's the thing. They're so lifeless.
No, I just don't want people to get sick, Maliki, John.
I don't
want them to get ill. I wish they'd pay attention. And
I
think we're
going
to have this with us for too many years.
I wish they would not go around infecting other people. They're a danger to. They're a danger. They're like people with guns. They should not be allowed into society.
We got rid of Cuomo. Newsom is on his way out in California, and DeSantis and Abbott, what I call them Abbott and Costello, they're responsible for the deaths of people in their own states because of their stupidity, their political nonsense. And there they stand, unchallenged. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, Malachi, because we said nobody was calling, the switchboard filled up, but we've run out of time. But I'm so glad we had David.
To answer the fascists.
This is WBAI, all fascist radio, all the time.
John, was like old BAI radio, somebody calling in with no substance, just calling names, fascist, communist, pinko. That's what BAI was back in the day. Everybody
what did you think shouting. About, you know what, David, I'll never forget when I was driving you and Malachi up 6th Avenue and the two of you telling Dorothy Parker stories. And it was just wonderful to sit there like I just
great.
Did.
Yeah, that was wonderful listening to old Dottie.
Yeah. Well,
right,
David,
guys, thank you for
we'll be listening to you on Monday,
with you.
10 o'clock, and on Saturday, 8 to 10.
I haven't finished Mein Kampf. I have to finish reading. I have the last chapter of Mein Kampf.
And he has the signed version. So, Malachi, next week we'll be talking about Angela's Ashes, the musical, coming to the Irish Repertory Theater. And I just love today's show because I only got to speak because I love it when people say to me, oh, that was a great show you had yesterday. I said, you didn't hear much of me, did you? And I said, that's because it was so riveting, you and Laurie. And we're going to go out dedicated to County Tyrone. We'll be playing Mayo in 2 weeks' time. And this is one of the more famous songs, but obscure, called The Craigan White Hair by Derry Farrell from Dublin. And Malachi, I'll talk to you later, and we'll see you next week on WBAI.
Thank you, David, for calling in. My God, we are honored to have you. You're a grand man.
Love being with you.
I never miss your show.
Heil, Malachi, heil.
Fellow fascist.
White hair and swift as the swallow that flies through the air. You may trap the world over, but none to compare to the pride of old Craigan, that funny white hair. One clear autumn morning, as you will suppose, over in golden sun o'er the green mountain rose, Barney Conway came down and he did declare, oh, this day I'll put an end to the bunny white hair. So he searched through the lowlands and down through the glens, all among the wild ditches where the white hair did ends, till at last, coming down over the heather so fair, from behind the wild thistle out he owns the white hair. Bang, bang went his guns and his dogs he slipped to, as swift as the wind o'er the green mountain flew. But his dog soon came back and it made Barney sigh. Barney knew that the white hair had bidden goodbye. And we're some jolly sportsmen down here from Pomroy, from Cookstown, Dungannon, and likewise the Moy. With our pedigree greyhounds we travel from. Go in search of the white hair, they'd look high and low, till at last Barney Conway from a bog bank so rare shouted out to the huntsmen, there lies the white hair. So they called up their greyhounds from off the green lea, Barney and the huntsmen all gee'em tightly. It was there on the bog bank all gathered around, seven dogs and nine men did not hair to tremble with fear, as she stood on her hind legs, she would raise her big ears. As she stood on her hind legs with 1 gallon spring, she jumped over the greyhounds and broke through the ring. Well, that chase it went on, it was a beautiful view, as swift as the wind o'er the green mount flew. But those pedigrees every greyhound's day didn't run far. I came back and went home in their fine motor car. Then there came another man, and you all know him well. His name was Mick Kelly with the bonny black bell. Search of the white hair today I'll have one. I'll bet 50 to 1 my black bell will hard turn. 5 turns the hair got in from Bunny Black Bell, and the 6th one was given around Gian Hoggy's well. It was there we lost sight of the hair and the tongue, and then 10 minutes later came more the black ball. Well, that chase it went on, it was great for to see. The white hare and the black dog both their own light and free. So she traveled to ask her where she knew the lands well, and to Bunny Black Bella there soon bid farewell. This rhyme, I hope you forgive me for singing all this while. If there's any amongst you in Carrickmore Fair, please drink up a health to that funny white mare.
You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Radio Free Erin with John McDonough and Maliki McCourt came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 12:30 is On Contact with Chris Hedges. Stay tuned.
Do you want your favorite WBAI programming to continue to air without the Fun Drive Day preemption? Becoming a BAI buddy is a great way to prevent that and to help support the station. Just by going to give2wbai.org, you can donate today. So before you decide to buy that electronic accessory for your smartphone, here are some more fulfilling ways to use that money with some perks. You can use your WBAI membership card and receive discounts on Zipcar, 2 for the price of 1 admission at the Museum of the City of New York, 20% off sessions with life and career coach Nina Della Vecchia, and much more. You will also receive a WBAI tote bag, which you can use to carry around some on-air giveaways. For more information, go to give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org.
I wear a mask for my fellow New Yorkers.
My mama, who's a healthcare worker.
Nurses and doctors.
For my father.
For the marginalized communities who don't have access to adequate healthcare.
For my children.
My community.
Essential workers.
Transit workers.
The immunocompromised.
I wear a mask so we can get back to work.
Go to school. Share a meal.
See a movie.
Hug my friends.
Dance together.
Go to the theater.
See our families.
Continue to show support.
Take care of each other.
Save lives.
Stay strong.
Extinction Diaries. There may have once been over 50,000 right whales in the Atlantic, up to 60 feet long, and named right whale because they were the easy right whale to hunt. Their numbers fell to just 100 individuals before being one of the first whale species protected in 1937. After only reaching just 500, a decline began, and by 2017 was accelerating when 18 individuals died. There were no births in 2018, and in 2019, a string of deaths made headlines as rights died entangled in fishing gear and boat strikes in the St. Lawrence region. Their numbers are now under 400 again. With the sixth great extinction spotlight on them, the right whale is like a canary in the coal mine, whose near-term future is an indication of just how successful humanity will be with our own survival. Without immediate, deep, and broad changes to how we treat the ocean, both the right whale and humans could share the same fate. My name is Cheyenne Sun Thunder. This is the Extinction Diaries, a Small World Radio production.
Greetings. Delegate elections are underway, and you are invited to leave a voicemail on 510-993-0320 with your questions and comments for candidates running to represent you on the local station board. We will invite all candidates to respond to your questions and produce an on-air election forum. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information about the delegate election process, and remember to vote before 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on October 15th.
Extinction Diaries. The Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia is 1,500 miles long. Since 2016, over half of the reef has died from agricultural pollution and ocean warming. Coral is an animal, and it gets its color from many diverse algae that attach to holes along their body. When coral is stressed, it ejects the algae and bleaches white, becoming immunocompromised. Then, much of the coral dies. Scientists have begun breeding and growing corals that have already shown powerful resistance to heat and bleaching. Much like a farmer crossing tomatoes, coral is being selectively grown for heat tolerance. Farmed coral is then reattached to existing or artificial reefs. Scientists are now researching low-light corals that survive at colder, deeper depths. Moving corals deeper until ocean temperatures cool again may be an option. Scientists and activists